Okay, so good evening. Thank you very much for coming here to this extremely stuffy room on a lovely evening. We will try and make your sacrifice worth its while. I am Ann Applebaum, and I'm a professor of practice at the LSE, where I run a program called ARENA, which looks at disinformation, propaganda, and how we're going to reconstruct some idea of shared public good in the 21st century. And it was really with that sort of hat on and that way of thinking that we decided it would be fun to invite our friends Yasha Monk and Sophie Gaston here tonight. I'm here, so I should say this is my colleague who co-runs ARENA with me, Peter Pomerantsev. And the two of us know that these are two colleagues who've worked on these issues from different perspectives. Yasha, probably as most of you know, is a lecturer at Harvard, yes? Is that
yes.
And the author of a new book called?
The People versus Democracy.
The People versus Democracy.
And it has a great subtitle, too.
What's the great subtitle?
Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It.
Right. So this evening we're gonna start actually with Yasha's book, and we'll outline the nature of the problem and then move rapidly on to the How to Save It piece of it. We're also really delighted to have Sophie Gaston with us. She was until recently, at the think tank Demos, and she is the author of a large piece of research, polling and examination of the question of nostalgia in different European countries. Why is nostalgia coming back? Why are people indulging in it? What it means? And we think her work and Yasha's work is related to what we do, and so we decided to do this event around these set of ideas. And the purpose, is to come up with some definitions of what the problem is, and then think a little bit about how we might solve them. We have an hour and a half. We can go until 8 o'clock. We'll talk among us. The four of us haven't had this conversation before. You saw us huddled over to the side there when you walked in. That's all we've done. So we can't tell you in advance what exactly it's going to get to. So you're seeing this is the real conversation right now. And then, of course, we'll want people to contribute if they so desire later on in the hour. Right. Why don't I begin with Yasha? Why don't you, for those who haven't read it yet, and by the way, the book is for sale, in fact, outside of the room, for those who want to buy it afterwards. But why don't you, for the benefit of those in the audience who haven't read it, why don't you define for us the nature of the problem, how you lay out what you think the challenge is to democracy, and maybe particularly with an eye to this problem of how we're all going to share a public sphere in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the argument of the book is that sort of two of the fundamental assumptions we had about liberal democracy in affluent developed countries are no longer true. The first is the widespread assumption that they're incredibly stable, that it perhaps doesn't surprise us that China hasn't yet become a democracy, that it perhaps doesn't surprise us that democracy in a country like Kenya is struggling for its survival. But in countries that, in the terms of one famous political science paper from the 1990s, have had at least two changeovers of government for free and fair elections, in countries that have more than about £12,000 a year in today's terms, GDP per capita, democracy was supposed to be safe. The idea was that it was the only game in town. Democratic consolidation was a one-way street, didn't have to worry about it. Well, as I show in the book, that assumption appears to be wrong. I started doing a lot of work about public attitudes before the year of Brexit and Donald Trump and before Italy went crazy and all of those things. And it showed that people actually aren't nearly as committed to democracy as we should assume, and they are much more open to autocratic alternatives to democracy. And of course, we are seeing the very rapid rise of a set of populist candidates and governments who don't, as political scientists assumed all real power holders in those kinds of democracies should, who don't have a real commitment to the basic rules and norms of our political system. So if you look at those kinds of authoritarian populists, They had about 8% of the vote share in the year 2000 in most European countries on average. Now they have over 25%. When you think of Winston Churchill's famous Iron Curtain speech, in which he said that from Staten in the north, in the Adriatic Sea, to Trieste in the south of Europe, an Iron Curtain was descending across the continent. Well, today you can drive along that Iron Curtain. You can start in the Baltic Sea, go down to the Adriatic, and either turn left all the way down to Bari in Palermo, or you can turn right all the way down to Athens, and you'll never leave a country ruled by populists. The populist belt has descended all across the center of Europe. And the election in Hungary a couple of months ago is not just, as my parents, who were schooled in communist schools in Poland, would have put it, so it's not just sort of an irrelevant little election in which a government is re-elected for a third time in a small Eastern European government. It's what my parents in the socialist school would have been taught to call a world historical event, which is to say that a man, Viktor Orban, who has turned state television stations into propaganda outlets, forced the sale of private stations into the hands of his adversaries. Just today, the biggest
weekly
sort of weekly that is critical of Orban has announced that it's closing. He has taken control of the Electoral Commission. He has committed massive fraud in the past election. And you take all of those things together, and it means that Hungary is no longer truly a democracy. So this is a world historical event because it disproves that theory from the 1990s. It shows that even affluent, well-established democracies can actually slide towards dictatorship. The second big assumption that I attack in the book is the idea that liberalism and democracy naturally go together. That once you have one of those two things, you can assume that the other will remain stable as well. Because as I point out, for a long time, our political systems have been insufficiently democratic. While we've largely been relatively good at protecting individual rights and the rule of law, we have, for two kinds of reasons, increasingly seen a system that doesn't really translate popular views into public policies. The first of these reasons is that parliaments and elected legislators have become less and less responsive to popular views, in part because of the role of money in politics, because of a revolving door between lobbies and legislators, because increasingly they are a milieu apart from the rest of the population. Just think of what percentage of Brits have not gone to university and what percentage of MPs have not gone to university as one simple example of that. And then secondly, because even insofar as parliaments are responsive to popular views, they often no longer take the most important decisions, whether it is in Europe, which is often takes a form of the European Union, but also whether it's in the United States, where an entity like the European Union doesn't exist. You have a whole set of independent agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency or the Consumer Protection Bureau, various quangos in this country who make important decisions. You have courts that have become more and more important and influential judicial review. You have central banks that both take more important decisions than we used to, and in many countries are more independent from politics than we used to be. You have trade treaties, and you have a whole set of international organizations. And you take all of those things together, and some of the most important decisions have actually been taken out of democratic contestation altogether. Now, in part as a response to that, you've seen the rise of what I would call illiberal democracy, or rights without democracy. The first thing is undemocratic liberalism or rights without democracy. The second, the sort of response to that, is a liberal democracy or democracy without rights. And that's essentially what the populists are and what the populists do. It is often to translate popular views into public policies, at least on some things in which people have strong views that have long been ignored, often at the cost of the rights of key ethnic, religious, and other minorities in particular countries. But it is also deeply illiberal, both in violating those rights and increasingly in undermining the kinds of things you need to uphold collective self-government in the long run. So these populists start, as Orban did in Hungary, to attack independent institutions, to attack the courts, to attack independent media outlets, and over time we get to the stage, as we now have in Hungary, in which it's practically impossible to displace a democratically elected leader by democratic means. So those are the core points of the book in terms of the analysis, and then there's also big parts in which I talk about the causes of this. Why is it that this is happening now? and start to talk about some of the remedies.
Why don't we focus on one of those causes? And that is partly thanks to social media, but also partly thanks to a kind of identity crisis that has occurred in a lot of Western democracies. We have a strange thing happening to what used to be a shared public sphere. I always find when describing this in Britain, it's a little bit harder than in some other places where people understand it intuitively, because in Britain, at the very least, as a kind of bedrock baseline thing, we still have the BBC. There's still a thing that most people watch or anyway are willing to watch. You know, there are some people who love it, some people who hate it, but it's still a unifying force. There are a lot of European countries where that doesn't exist, where there is either the public broadcaster is discredited or it's now one-sided, where the media space is profoundly divided, so much so that people live in very separate echo chambers that don't speak to one another. I mean, actually, this is the case in the United States. It's the case in Poland, where I spend some of the time. It functions to a degree, particularly in smaller European countries. Why don't you speak a little bit about that problem, and then I'll ask Sophie what she has to say about it as well.
Yeah, so the way that I talk about the importance of the rise of internet and social media in the book is to point out that 25 years ago, and this was sort of a puzzling claim, our media world was not so different from what it would have been like 200 years ago. Now, that seems silly because 25 years ago, you could already broadcast the World Cup live with good sound and picture quality to, you know, TV sets all around the world. And obviously, 200 years ago, you couldn't do that. But it was a form structurally of one-to-many communication, which is to say that in order to have a real voice in public discourse, you had to either own a television station, a radio station, a newspaper, a publishing house, or be featured on those platforms by its governors and owners. That meant that there was a certain kind of elite, which was often centered in particular cities and came from a particular kind of milieu, who could make a lot of the most important decisions about who was featured on those channels and who wasn't. Now, over the last 25 years, we've had two transformations of that. The first, which is the rise of the internet and of website, which democratized one-to-many communication, where it was incredibly expensive to print lots and lots of pamphlets in 1992. By the end of a decade, you could have a website for very little money, and a vast number of people around the world who had access to the internet could come and access that website. Now, it was still unclear why we would go to your website rather than guardian.co.uk or thetimes.co.uk, because we might not know about that website. So that's where the second transformation comes in, which is the rise of social media. It's a transformation from one-to-many communication to many-to-many communication. Suddenly, even if you only have 50 followers on Twitter and you make a particularly cute video of your cat or you film a particularly shocking instance of police violence, within a couple of hours, millions of people can see that video. And that means that the social gatekeepers who had such power 25 years ago have become completely disempowered. That can be a good thing. It can be a good thing in certain dictatorships where it makes it easier for the opposition.
Being a good
opposition.
Thing in certain democracies, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, in democracies, I was on a stage about 2 weeks ago with one of the survivors from the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, who has been very courageous in advocating for some forms of gun control and who shot to national prominence within days, thanks to social media. So it can absolutely empower some important voices that had been marginalized and excluded earlier, but it also makes it easier for people who are hateful or want to spread fake news and so on to have a real voice. Now, why is it that social media has had such a bad impact in our situation? I think to answer that question, you have to go a little bit beyond social media. And that's why in the book I also talk about the stagnation of living standards for ordinary citizens, the rebellion among parts of the population against the transition to a more equal multi-ethnic society, because it is the economic anger and the fear of that demographic transition that make people lose trust in politics and pessimistic about the future. And it's in that context that the ability of social media to empower radical voices becomes a force for quite worrying rather than potentially constructive.
It also has had the phenomenon, maybe I'll ask Peter to talk about it a little bit more, of dividing. It's made it possible and in some ways has encouraged the division of the public conversation. So much so that there are, you know, there are in many European countries, it's not that people just disagree about, you know, what they think about you know, what's going on in society. They actually don't agree about what happened yesterday. So people are functioning in almost separate political spheres where they use different facts and they have, you know, they have a different idea of what's happening in their societies. And that, I think, makes it very hard to have a democracy at all. I mean, if you can't agree, what are the main themes for today? What's happening? You know, what are the problems? Then you can't really have any kind of normal normal debate.
Well, one of the ways to think about that, I think, is that when sort of human beings have an innate instinct to gravitate towards the views of a median in a group, right? You don't want to be in a group and have completely different views from everybody else. And usually our groups were pretty geographically based. Now, there might be a slightly different median view in Islington than in, you know, the middle of the home counties. But that range was relatively limited. And so somebody who was in a school, somebody who was in a university, in a workplace, there would always be around these other people. And so they would be sort of drawn towards more moderate views. Social media has this ability to for us to construct our own village. Mm-hmm. I just follow the people who are like me, who have the same interests, who have some of the same views, and suddenly the reference group is no longer the people who are around me geographically. It is my universe of 100 people who are my Facebook friends or my Twitter people I most interact with. And so suddenly conforming to that group medium can pull me towards the extreme rather than towards the middle. And that's a really big transformation as well. Now, shut up because I want to hear from Sophie.
Right. So Sophie, why don't you describe your research in the way that it relates to this problem? Because Sophie has looked at this question of nostalgia, because one of the ways in which people have coped with this division of the public sphere and the confusion that it's created is they've lapsed back into nostalgia for a simpler time.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. The report is called At Home in One's Past, and it's interesting because I, like you, have been looking at this issue of polarization for so long that we keep thinking about what divides us. And with this research, I was speaking to all sorts of people from all walks of life, but the people I was engaging with the least, the kind of cosmopolitan liberals with whom we all spend most of our time. And what was very interesting about it was the immense consensus amongst everybody else, with whom a lot of people in Westminster, or you know, whether you're in Berlin or Paris or whatever, engage with the least. So the research essentially had three kind of core thematic lenses, I suppose, through which I was exploring this question of nostalgia and, you know, why the past has such currency at the moment. And that was the lens of citizens. I was also looking at political campaigns and then sort of thinking about what all of this means for governance. And I think on the citizen level, the study of nostalgia essentially becomes a kind of catalogue of grievances about the present day. And it also is a kind of agglomeration of fears about the future as well. And these are the two driving forces of people finding an appeal and a comfort in the past.
And is part of the appeal and the comfort the memory of a time when we were all more unified and we all agreed with one another and everything was more homogenous?
Absolutely. And it's, you know, community was one of the strongest buzzwords that kept coming out in every focus group that I did, whether that was in Britain or France or Germany. Everybody spoke about this breakdown of community, a shift to a more individualized society, this lack of solidarity. And I think it's quite important because in the end, I found sort of two core constituencies for nostalgic thinking and belief. One of them, it's these people who are, I suppose, you know, we say in this sort of what's become quite lazy parlance now, but the left behind. So these are people who are living in deindustrialized communities, and they actually have genuinely lived through a decline in their prospects, in their living standards, in their opportunities. You know, in some pretty miserable towns, places that once had a sense of status and may now be described as a kind of backwater. And what was really interesting about that is again, there's been quite a lot of discussion around the role of economic decline and economic change in this sort of emergence of nostalgia, and I think it is very important. But for these people, the things they were talking about, it was that loss of community that had built up around that industry. It was that loss of status. It was the loss of, you know, a sense of agency as well, political agency and representation. The second group are a much larger group, actually, and they are not necessarily all from low socioeconomic groups. In fact, maybe they have not suffered any kind of material deprivation in their life. In fact, maybe their living standards have improved. They have experienced and enjoyed social mobility. But for these people, the nostalgia is driven by a kind of compound stress. And all the contributing factors to that stress, we may describe them as kind of cultural or more social in nature. And for them, it is actually about this process of adapting constantly to new norms and social mores and so on. So I think it was quite interesting seeing people in these focus groups actually forming communities. We do focus on the sort of collectivism having been undermined by the shift to individualism, but actually what we're also forming is new kind of tribes.
Well, that was what Yasha was just talking about.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think in so far as this pertains to the public sphere, it's actually also about a contesting of narratives and these contested narratives about the past and how they're actually playing into contested narratives of the present. And a lot of politicians have been incredibly effective at harnessing and weaponizing the past, and it's having real consequences in our contemporary political system.
Peter, one of the, I'll ask you a question, then I hope we'll all ask one another questions, but one of the goals of our project has been to look at what is polarization and how we end it. Do you want to begin the piece of this discussion about how we fix this problem and explain?
Yeah, no, just listening to Sophie, and I was remembering my own journeys during the last election, where I'd hear these words a lot. I did the very original thing of getting off at every stop along the East Coast line between London and Edinburgh, which, you know, was one I was very familiar with from my student days, and getting to know all these places along the way. And I'd hear the word, I went around doing, you know, with local political campaigners, and I actually heard the word community a lot. And at one point I was like, and this was in South Yorkshire, and I was like, look, why do people keep on talking about community? What do they mean? And I was asking the local Tory campaigners, like, look, it's just racism. What they mean is that they don't like foreigners. Because nobody wanted to say I'm racist. Well, they meant we've lost a lot of community here. And that's what they were talking about. But then I went to other places, Darlington, for example, where people were much more overtly racist, but where there was actually no ethnic tension, because there was hardly any ethnic change there. It was, you know, I can't remember where I was, Bishop Stortford or somewhere, and it was 99% white and hadn't changed. And there they were talking about something completely different, it turned out. When I turned to talk to the local MP, she was like, you've got to understand, people here really aren't racist. What they are, though, is there's been a massive loss of status. People used to be very proud of being from Darlington. It used to be the great manufacturer of bridges and trains, the whole world. And actually, the employment was still quite good. Yeah, there was still quite good employment there. There wasn't a massive crisis like in Doncaster. But what she said was, because the dominant narrative on TV, on the BBC, in all our culture had been to celebrate our multi-ethnic nature, people felt really left out because there was no multi-ethnic nature to celebrate there. They're like, hold on. And so the kind of conclusion they got to was, damn you and your multi-ethnicity. What they wanted was their own stake in globalisation, actually. So it could have been something as simple as, let's make more TV programmes about that, you know, about their point of view and about their lives. But it was interesting, they weren't actually racist, even though there a lot of the rhetoric was much more obviously anti-immigrant. But I was listening to what Yasha was saying, and I remembered during that journey trying to understand more about how political campaigns were operating in a social media environment. And it's the same pattern I've seen in England now, in the US, I've seen it in Mexico, I've seen it in Italy, and of course today, the charming, wonderful epitome of all that is English, Alexander Nix, was giving testimony to Parliament. And
this is the man from Cambridge Analytica.
Exactly. So sort of the fallout of this sort of shift to social media has been a new type of political campaigning. It was actually described most elegantly to me by a spin doctor in Mexico. So basically, think about it from the point of view of a political campaigner. You get up in the morning, and political campaigning spend has shifted massively towards social media around 2016. And you have to target these very different groups that Yasha was talking about.
The different tribes
formed different
online.
Different online tribes, all very, very different causes, all very, very different interests. And instead of thinking kind of an overarching story that you're going to give to people, you start targeting them in ways which might well be very contradictory. So during a recent referendum here, for example, a huge amount of effort was put into convincing people that are really into animal rights, that the EU is terrible for animal rights, because bullfighting, the EU supports bullfighting, and there are EU regulations which say that you have to transport animals before you slaughter them, which is actually quite uncomfortable for the animals. And at the same time, you'd be telling a very different story to a different group about how terrible the EU was for migration or something. Yeah? I mean, people who are into animal rights are probably quite pro-migration, but you're sending them a completely different story to the ones over here. So
Anne told me to try and told all of us to try and disagree with each other as much as possible, so we don't just sort of so in that spirit.
Yeah, okay.
You know, that's a lot of a narrative about what happened in the 2016 election in the United States as well. Cambridge Analytica was brilliant at dividing people up, inciting hatred against each other, at sort of micro-targeting people based on their psychological profiles and so on.
And we know that's what the Russians were doing too. Yeah.
Right, I don't buy any of that. They may have had a little difference at the margin, but when you look at the election as a whole, I would say it's nearly the inverse, which is that Hillary Clinton went out and said, all right, you know, here I have the demographic breakdown of how I'm going to win the election. And part of it was about, you know, what some people call identity politics or whatever. But a lot of it was just, you know, suburban moms who were into this kind of thing and so on. She's like, okay, so how do I appeal to each of these groups? I'm going to have a policy platform with 317 pranks. And, you know, if you are somebody who has an autistic child, I'm going to have a great policy that actually appeals to you and I'm going to win your vote. And then when I add together all of the different groups to which I appeal, we're going to have a majority, right? And the problem is that then she held speeches in which she said, well, the first thing I'm going to do, and the second thing I'm going to do, and the third thing I'm going to do, and you were supposed to wait till point 15 until you were spoken to. But you'd switch the TV off after point 3. And in fact, CNN had cut away to the empty lectern that showed Donald Trump. And what did Donald Trump talk about? He talked about something that certainly didn't appeal to a certain part of America, which is to say that, you know, it was primarily towards white people and so on and so forth. But he told a story that was, here's how I'm going to make America great. Here's how I'm going to speak to all of you. And it was a bullshit story. I didn't buy it, but it was actually a story that did speak to Americans as Americans. And so I don't quite believe that micro-targeting thing, because the big headline story about the 2016 election seems to have been the opposite.
Well, if I may continue with the story of the Mexican campaigner, he was just about to end. I had exactly that question as we sat in Polanco. I had exactly that question. We've seen the opposite. We're seeing
this is working out great, Dan.
So, that's a brilliant point. So, he continued. So, imagine you're the campaigner. You're selling these very contradictory messages to different people. So, in order to bring that all together, you then need something very, very vague. Yeah? What, you know, some people might call a floating signifier, but which is so vague that people can imagine their own meaning into it, like leaving the EU, or build a wall, or the people. Yeah? So the campaigner explained his whole job now was to create an idea of the people which is so vague that people could project themselves into it and have a symbolic floating policy, make America great again, which means nothing, that people could just say, okay, my problem is part of making America great again. And of course, and this is the clincher, if you create an idea of the people, which is very amorphous, you have to give them an enemy, the non-people. Whether that's immigrants, whether that's the EU, the establishment, and that's what gives it narrative coherence.
So, and why couldn't the campaigns have been doing both, which is what I thought they were doing? I mean, the On the one hand, I mean, because the Trump campaign was clearly micro-targeting, as well as doing this big vague message, they were doing voter suppression. They were also trying to reach people who they thought might be Hillary Clinton voters and persuading them not to vote for her. You know, they knew they couldn't win them, but they could maybe say, I mean, there's a famous campaign that was directed at Haitians in Florida, mm-hmm. which said, oh, the Clintons were involved in helping Haiti after the hurricane, and they stole a lot of money, and it was all very corrupt. You know, don't vote for the Clintons. And so that was a piece of micro-targeting that took place under the umbrella of the Trump campaign.
No, I think both of those things clearly did go on. I just think that, you know, when you try to understand how a candidate as radical and frankly unfit for office as Donald Trump could have come close to the presidency, I think it's about the way in which populist political language and imaginary actually mobilizes people, and the failure of other parts of the political spectrum to provide a unifying message that is a grand vision rather than, you know, a set of technocratic fixes designed to appeal to a set of subpopulations. Now, all of the targeting stuff, which, by the way, didn't have huge budgets, right? I'm sure it did make a difference, and it may well have been the thing that put Donald Trump over the top at the end. I think that's quite plausible, because in the end it was, you know, 100,000 votes in three states and so on and so forth. But I think if you want to understand why is it that we're in this moment in the first place, why is it that populists are rising all around the world, I just don't think that Cambridge Analytica and so on is the thing to look at. Because it seems to me that, you know, if you don't have a deeply divided country, if you don't have people who, you know, 40 years ago said, yeah, in the end, look, I don't love politicians, but you know what, they are kind of trustworthy. And now a tiny minority says that politicians are trustworthy and by and large try to do the right thing. I mean, it's those transformations that create openings for people like Trump and so on. And it's Cambridge Analytica stuff and so on that gives them the extra 2 or 3 or 4%, which can help them win elections, but that can be hugely consequential. But I don't think that explains why we have somebody like Trump in our politics in the first place today, and we didn't 20 or 40 or 60 years ago.
But what, and here it's more a question, what they seem to have in common. I think you said a very important thing there about sort of the populist language. If you look at whether it's Pepe Grillo in Italy and everyone else, they seem to tap into sort of linguistic formulations which are full of swear words, full of references sort of to the body, and they're full of, you know, they encapsulate the sort of linguistically this rebellion against the elites. But they also seem to have this motif, and this is for your theme, Sophie, of nostalgia. And they don't seem to articulate clear ideas of the future and where we're going, or even clear ideologies in that sense. Partly because, I think you're quite right, all ideologies have sort of failed us, and there's no sort of sense that there is a common idea of progress. And I wonder, as we start to think about how to counteract this, isn't that where we need to start? Do we have to start generating ideas of a common future, which would then generate a future, you know, generate a narrative where we can start to come together around that conversation in a way which is, I suppose, fact-based?
And what if it's the case, though, that the idea of the common future also has to be explained in different ways to these different audiences? I mean, if people are no longer listening to the BBC or, I don't know, Walter Cronkite, CBS Evening News, then the way in which even a unifying political campaign has to reach people, it's going to have to do it in multiple different ways and in different tones. In a way, that's what the Five Star Movement, which is really one of the most interesting experiments. I mean, there are all kinds of negative things about it, of course, but it's a very interesting experiment in political technology because it is actually a political campaign that's attached to a social media operation. So it is literally a million messages about vaccines and the EU and also universal wages and, you know, multiple messages targeted at multiple people under the umbrella of, you know, screw you, Italian government. That's the polite version of it. But sorry, Sophie.
Well, because populists are railing against the establishment, they don't necessarily need to convince. They convince through sowing doubt. And it's actually quite an interesting playbook if you actually look back at the sort of climate change denial lobby. There's been a lot of this. And actually, I think the Leave campaign was quite adapted this as well. It's if you are trying to convince people that there's something wrong with today, you don't have to necessarily say this is going to be better. You just have to make them feel, oh, actually, maybe things aren't going so well. And I think this is where nostalgia becomes quite important, because we have had this doctrine of progress for, you know, 20, 30 years. And all you have to do is convince people, and this is where it does become a kind of collective identity. You just have to convince people to actually interrogate their own circumstances. And I think the problem is that today, one man's progress is another man's decline. And, you know, I think if we are thinking about why do these narratives of the past feel so strong and compelling for people, you know, why is it that in the referendum, both the Leave and Remain campaign were, you know, drawing on the Second World War whenever they possibly could, and they were wheeling out every possible veteran they could find on the street to say, this is the historical continuum for this choice.
Yes, there was the wonderful Battle of the Generals. We have Leave generals and Remain generals. Yes.
And this, to me, I think it really speaks to the fact that we have not been able to create a kind of contemporary historical story, you know, something that feels as compelling as that, something that is so grounding, something that is uniting. I mean, the last time that we had a sense of projecting a kind of social and political and international vision of Britain was Cool Britannia, and that was ultimately proven to be quite superficial.
So there's always, you know, there's always a temptation of nostalgia in politics, for a very simple reason that, you know, for most people, life was better 30 years ago than it is today, just because they were younger, right? Yeah. So there's a sort of basic temptation of nostalgia in politics, and the question is, why is it so much stronger now than it was at other times, right? And I think that does go back to some of those cultural and economic changes, right? I mean, we have really good data on this for the United States, not yet as good for the United Kingdom, but there was only about 10% of the population in, say, 1975 that couldn't say, when my parents were the same age as I was, around 30, they were not better off than I am, right? So the vast majority of the population could say, I'm much better off today than I was, than my parents would have been at my age, right? Now, it's 50% of the population, five times as many people who can say, hey, you know what? My parents' life was better. And even, you know, that's not just the left behind. You can see that even in parts of London, right? I mean, if you have a pretty good job in London today, let's say you're a junior academic at the LSE, decent job.
Pretty good job.
You probably have real trouble finding a place to live in London that's half decent. And depending on where you grew up, you might well say, I'm not actually ever going to have quite the standard of living that my parents had, right? And so I think that provides a very good, straightforward explanation for why old people, but also young people, have a feeling that, well, yeah, things were in certain ways better 30 years ago, right? And then you add to that the status anxiety that comes with a transition to a multi-ethnic society, right? Which is not just about particular grievances and certain failures of integration and so on. It's also just about things that you can care about even if your life hasn't gotten worse in any kind of way. But it may have gotten positionally worse, right? So if you're not the most talented and richest and most respected guy in the country, 30 years ago in most European countries, you could say, well, you know what, at least I'm part of a majority rather than one of these whatever people, right? At least I'm, you know, from Sweden or Italy or whatever rather than, you know, Turkish or Moroccan or whatever else, right?
No, absolutely.
And as, thankfully, the status of a lot of these immigrant groups has improved, as they've started to perhaps be your boss or whatever, you know, you can no longer default to that kind of instant advantage. And so people have a nostalgia for the social status they had, which...
Yeah. No, I have the counterexample that wrecks your theory.
All right.
Which is the example of Poland. Poland is a country where everybody is better off than they were.
Mm.
Nobody is worse off than their parents. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating, but really only a tiny bit. I mean, you can do any kind of statistical breakdown you want, and people are better off than they were 25 years ago, and certainly than they were 30 years ago. And and we're actually, and nostalgia is something very complicated. I mean, nobody in politics or in public life is openly nostalgic for communism, and nobody talks about it or celebrates it or wants it back. Just, you know, just don't hear it at all. There is a nostalgia, though, for something else, and I don't know whether it's a desire for simplicity or whether it's the human instinct towards authoritarianism, which I am now more worried about than I was, or the preference for certain, you know, predictable hierarchies, but also this. But I mean, but my main point is that this is, there is no way you can describe this as economic. I mean, you can't use those same. To, you know, and nevertheless, you have this very powerful, you know, the bifurcation of society into two kind of tribal groups. You know, one which likes the president and is excited about the future, and the other which defines itself as the real Poland, who want a homogenous ethnic state or some version of that, and who are rejecting for it. But you can't argue either that it's nostalgic in the classic sense or that it's really economic, because both groups are better off.
So I think that is a very serious counterexample, and you know, basically you're right, but social media is the one thing that's at play everywhere. I mean, the thing that's difficult to describe is populism is rising in so many different contexts, right? I mean,
Peter was talking
Sweden
today
and in Germany
about
and in Britain and the States and the Philippines and India and Turkey, right? So it's difficult to find factors that really are in common in all of those different places.
Except
and
social
media is one of them. And that's a strong argument for why social media matters. Now, let me make an argument for why I still think that both of the main explanations I give apply in different ways to Poland. So the economic argument, obviously life is better for 99% of people in Poland today than it was 30 years ago, right? But I do think that people have concerns about the economy and feel like there's an unfairness there. I think that often they feel like the people who profited in the early 90s and basically became the new ruling class are illegitimate. That often, whether it's true or not, but often they're former communist officials, or they bribe people, or they're crooked, or whatever,
ago, it's
right?
Not true now, yeah.
And so, you know, there's an unfairness in who it is who got rich. There's a very strong sense of being left behind regionally, right? I mean, I think people were promised that they were going to go and have the same standard of living as you do in Germany, in France, in the United Kingdom. When you go to Warsaw, not quite, but nearly, for a lot of people, when you go to the smaller towns and villages, you're just very far from that. So even though the life is much better than it was, there's still a real distance to it. There's a lack of opportunity for young people in some of those more rural places and so on. And so you get depopulation and the young and smart people moving out in a way that makes people feel very worried, right? And then the same thing with immigration, right? You have very little immigration in Poland, even less so in other parts of Central Europe. But you have a very live understanding of how Western Europe has transformed in various ways, often a caricatured understanding of how Western Europe has transformed, and a very live fear that the same thing might happen, right? So, you know, when you look at the immigrant numbers to Poland and Hungary and Bulgaria, it's ridiculous that people are worried about that, but it's very clear that they are worried about it. In Eurobarometer, when you ask people, what are your two most concerns, up and down Central Europe, terrorism, by which we mean Islamist terrorism, and immigration. And, you know, there's no terrorist attacks there, and there's no immigration, but clearly people are worried about it. So I still think that there's versions of that argument that apply there.
I wanted to bring the wonderful thing about this issue is that it immediately slides into so many other deep questions. But I just wanted to bring it back to our main theme today. So maybe we're all being a little bit nostalgic, because we keep on saying, okay, how do we rebuild the public sphere in order to have a deliberative democracy, which I think many people have pointed out, I think David Runciman does very well in his new book, we're really just talking about the last 100 years, it's not, you know, 500 years. And maybe we're being very nostalgic for a, you know, a strange compromise of parties which represented us, media which seemed extensions of us, maybe we just can't go back to that. Do you think we'll go back to what it was, or how do we reinvent constructing some sort of common politics together, or maybe we don't need to.
Or maybe it's not reinvent. Maybe it's something completely new. So that, I mean, the question is, what? How does it look? You got to some of this at the end of your book, you know, but so, all right, so we have this divided sphere, we have a part of the public that's no longer satisfied with democracy. Is there a way to bring back some, I mean, I don't even mean you know, recreate what we had in the 1950s. I mean, bring back a shared sense of responsibility, so that there aren't some groups in society who think, you know, we're the real Poles, or we're the real Frenchmen, or we're the real English, and you know, and they're not. How do you? Because you need, whatever you call it, you need some kind of agreement that we all live in this country together, and we are, you know, in order to have a democracy, we need to respect one another's views, and therefore, you know, and we need this thing called the public sphere, which we haven't thought of a better expression for.
So I think that there's three dimensions to that, right? There's policy, there's identity, and there's institutions. Now, on policy, I think it's quite clear that we're not going to be able to just go back, right? And the whole problem of the 2016 election in the United States, in some ways, the Brexit referendum, is that it looked like a sort of choice between an extremist politics of change and a moderate politics of the status quo. And it turns out that in those circumstances, people have to go for the extremist politics of change, not necessarily because they're extremists, but because they really want things to change. So I mean, the only way to stand up to populists is to have a policy of change that's more sensible and moderate, but that does actually promise to say, hey, we're really going to change how taxation works, we're going to change how housing works, we're really going to change how we train people in a way that does give you a realistic hope for a better future. On identity...
So counter-radicalism.
Yeah, I think so, but not, I mean, you know, in an evidence-based way, in a sensible way, because there's a real distinction between us and the populists, which is that the populists can make huge promises, and they don't care if they break them. A, because après moi le déluge, if they're thrown out of office again, they don't care, they've, you know, scammed their money and whatever else. And B, because then they have other tools to stay in power, as we're seeing in places like Hungary and Poland and so on, right? Now, that's not true for more modern forces.
In Poland, not yet. They haven't cheated yet. We might get there.
Well, they've obviously taken over the judiciary and so on. If moderate parties manage to get to power with huge outside promises without any ideas behind them, then 4 or 8 years later, they're going to be swept aside by the populists. So it's a long-term game we've got to play. And that's a real challenge, right? Because the second thing is identity, right? There is no alternative to building an equal multi-ethnic democracy, which includes, in my mind, an inclusive patriotism, in which we do retain some real form of national belonging, but one that obviously doesn't exclude people on the basis of their origin or their skin color or their religion. There's no alternative, because what on earth is the alternative in countries that already are quite multi-ethnic? I mean, one alternative is you deport everybody who looks different. That looks difficult to do and horrible. The other alternative is basically to have an ethnically tinged underclass for a foreseeable future, so we turn into sort of, you know, versions of the worst of Latin America. I don't think that's appealing to everybody. So we've got to build an equal multi-ethnic society.
I can say it's not the solution, but again, just to use the Polish example, Poland has managed to create what's essentially political tribal warfare with no ethnicities at all.
Right.
So you don't even need different ethnic groups in order for different pieces of society to say you're not really Polish.
Absolutely. Right. And then the third question is around the institutions. And there I do think that, you know, social media and democracy, there is a real case, which I do make in the book, around the fact that, well, 2 points, but our democracy was built on a kind of myth, right, which is to say that it didn't originate in order to be a democracy. I mean, in the United States, this is very explicit. My favorite text to teach to American undergrads is The Federalist Papers, in which James Madison says, you know, we're building a republic, not a democracy. The definition of a republic is the total exclusion of the people in the collective capacity from any share in the government. That surprises them a little bit, right? And over the course of the 19th century, you know, egalitarian sentiment rises and we redescribe our institutions as democracies. And how do we get to do that? Why do we get to do that? We get to do it because it's impossible for us all to meet in one place and so on. And so, you know, the system of representation is the sort of best, second best we can have, right? Now, I think social media puts a lot of pressure on that idea, because people now have an instinctive understanding that, you know, I can go on Facebook and, you know, something has 5 likes and I click on the thumbs up button and it lights up blue and the 5 jumps to a 6, and that's what direct efficacy looks like, right? And so I think what we can do is we have to preserve the two basic values of liberal democracy, which is individual liberty and collective self-rule. But we can rethink to some extent the kind of institutional setup we need in order to preserve those. And thinking of ways to use digital tools in our democracy to make it more responsive and to make it more seem more natural to people, I think is something to think about. For when it comes to specifics, I tend to be quite skeptical of any one proposal that I've then come across for how to actually do that.
I think on this point, and to what you were saying about, you know, Poland and these tribes and divisions without, I think we do focus a lot on immigration and cultural pluralism as a kind of dividing line, but there are so many other forms of social conflict at the moment as well, and competition. And the important thing is that we've got to a point where citizens, that there is a framework of resource scarcity, and that's around state resources, but it's also around political agency. And there are all sorts of competitions going on in society around those resources and agency. And I think we need to also think beyond cultural pluralism to, say, intergenerational conflict or culture wars or, you know, divisions of the mind.
So did your research lead you to do any thinking about what are the unifying factors? What could you point, you know, other than this kind of repetitive and somewhat empty nostalgia, what are the other things that politicians could do or media could do or others could do to create that sense of, you know, common shared space?
Well, at the end of the research, I did some surveys in Britain, and rather depressingly, the three points of consensus across the population and
the NHS.
No. These were through this nostalgic frame, but and I say that these are large points of consensus, and, you know, Leave, Remain, Labour, Tory, right across, is one that you know, things were better in the past. Great. Two, that immigration has divided societies in Britain. And three, that the British government has utterly failed to defend and promote British values. And that was, and it's interesting that these are points of consensus. And I think on that last point, you know, when people talk about change and it being overwhelming, and as I said before, these kind of compound stresses, people just want to turn to the government for a kind of, they want these anchors. They want to know that even in the face of all of this change and upheaval, that there are things that will be immovable about the experience of their life in Britain. And, you know, I think that is the point of political leadership. They have to define what those things are going to be, and they have to set that up in a story.
Peter?
It's all so vast.
Narrow it down. Pick a slice.
That's the first time I've seen you stumped for words.
Won't last long. So I'll just come back to what we're doing in Arena to try to tackle a tiny bit of it. And then some of the other things that I'm thinking of percolating through this discussion, which really strike me as fascinating.
And then we'll talk about
how is that story going to be generated? I think it's clear, as Yasha so brilliantly points out, it's not going to be a sort of a one-to-many process anymore. Something has changed. Social media seems to be setting up a different set of relationships. Every time, you know, one goes online and shares a picture of oneself, one is already an influencer, a propagandist, a storyteller. And that was kind of the dream of social media at the start. It was going to bring everybody together in a collaborative process, and somewhere along the line that seemed to have stumbled. So how do we start reinventing the architecture, maybe, of social media to make it true to that original promise? Is there actually still within it embedded a way to start generating these dreams, but also these maybe new institutions that we need in order to have this shared reality together?
Or even in traditional media.
Yeah, or even just not killing each other, shared reality. That's a little bit grand. Let's just, like, you know, just talking to each other again. Again, I think in Britain it's not as far gone. I think in America it does feel that way sometimes. Mm. So you know, we're just really at the start of that. The challenge that we're thinking about is how can media get up in the morning? And instead of thinking, how do I feed into that kind of tribal polarizing mentality, which social media can do, and get more clicks and likes by doing more ridiculous stories about democratic conspiracies or about Donald Trump as a monster conspiracies, and how does it actually get up in the morning and think, how do I reach the people who are on the other side of the divide at the moment? How can I actually use some of maybe the thinking behind understanding audiences, understanding people's data, to start bridging those divides and bringing them into a conversation? actually, a lot of that skill is embedded in the old and dying craft of public diplomacy, which is how governments used to think, how do I talk to a foreign population? Now our nations have become foreign populations to each other. How can we start using some of those skills? And we're just at the start of that journey. But that would be, I think, a first step. And what's interesting about social media is that it can actually give us metrics to do that. I remember talking to an engineer at Facebook recently, and he was like, we could measure that so easily. We could look at constructive engagement. What sort of media content actually promotes constructive engagement? What sort of media content promotes a sense of shared reality? But that, he meant, people talking about the same facts in the same way. So there's a massive potential there in social media, and maybe we have to go right to the root of it. I mean, maybe we have to start thinking about taking some sort of ownership of the algorithms, whether a public ombudsman for algorithms, so that it really starts, and we can see inside the black box of social media, really start seeing how you can, really on a technological engineering level, start to smooth some of these, some of this polarization. But it's that's just the start of a journey that we're on. I haven't thought of anything better yet. I mean, do you have any ideas, Sophie?
I think that we if we're looking at social media, we also need to take a step back and look at what's going on in our political systems, right? There is an inherent symbiosis between social fragmentation and political polarization. And it's been incredibly effective as a campaigning mechanism for politicians to harness and seize on these cleavages, and they're perpetuating. So we need to bring back more kind of civilized discourse. There needs to be more public, open, constructive debate. We need parties working more with each other. They need to be thinking about big national challenges and so on. I mean, we've got to the point, if you think about the Salisbury poisoning, for example, you know, in the past, that could have been an issue that united, actually, both sides of the house. And instead, it, you know, actually just highlighted the divisions. And I was giving a talk just 2 days after that, and there were all sorts of conspiracy theories that were being promoted in that audience amongst, you know, from otherwise, you know, well-educated people. And this is because we've created space in our political system for this kind of thinking.
That seems a good moment to ask if there are any conspiracy theorists in the audience. No, sorry. if there's anybody who would like to contribute. I'll take kind of two or three questions or comments. I didn't mind if they're not questions, actually. We can take comments. But if they could just be concise, that's all I ask.
You get to rant for 280 characters.
You have 280 characters equivalent, and then if you want to rant further, you can do it on social media like we do. So.
Hashtag whatever.
Hashtag whatever, right. And we have microphones, right? Let me take one from the front row, and then I'll go to the back.
Hi, I will be very concise.
And yes, introduce
yourself. I'm Sergei Guliev. I'm Eric 2.0, Eric's successor at the BRD. My question is not about the demand for populism, economics, identity, culture, and so on. My question is about supply of populists. So you have the breakdown of the traditional mainstream parties, you have vacant space, and in some countries you have populists entering. In some countries, you have new mainstream actors entering, like Macron or Ciudadanos, which actually make sure that, well, populists don't have a vacant space. In some places, populists go to power, and instead of becoming irresponsible, become centrists, like Syriza, for example, right? So the question is, what is about the political institutions, culture, identity that determines supply of populist or non-populist politicians to take this space that mainstream parties became?
Yeah, I actually think it's flukes, but anyway.
I love the economist's question, you know, what's the supply and demand here?
Right, well, let's take a couple more, and then I'll let everybody think about it while they're... So, what, cut two in the way back. Let's just take them in geographically.
Thank you. Right, so as you...
And if you want to introduce yourself, just...
Yes, I'm Vlad. I'm a data scientist. Right, so as you very well pointed out, populism has thrived in very different, very sort of heterogeneous contexts. You have countries like some countries in Eastern Europe, such as Poland, which have enjoyed a fairly long period of prosperity. You have other countries like the US and the UK, and you have where there is a sort of quite strong cynicism about the political politics and politicians. For example, in Scandinavia and Denmark, people are quite trusting of politics. They're very, very different countries. Do you think there's something fundamentally different between populism in these countries, or is there some kind of sort of fundamental similarity between those?
Right. So are all these the same version of the same populism, or are they different? Okay, let's take one other one.
Hi. Thank you for an interesting debate. Right. You started to touch on the concept of democracy. Well, you used the word democracy, and I think we really need to be sure that in our country it's supposed to be representative democracy. And I think that's, and in the US, that's probably where one of the problems lie. There was, Sophie mentioned just briefly, the alienation of people from the political process now. What we probably need to do is go back to proper representative democracy. We have MPs who are mostly not representative people. They're not like the people they're supposed to be representing, don't understand them. And that's shown very clearly, I think, in the Brexit discussion result, basically. We've also got so much whipping that goes on in House of Commons that no MP can actually vote freely what they believe to be correct. And so again, they're not necessarily representing their constituents. There are so many issues, first-past-the-post systems, that are not representative. Many people are don't have a vote, basically, in that system. So people don't trust the system at all, and if we went back to a system where it would be more representative, then maybe that would help the situation.
Right, so do we need different kinds of representatives? I'll take one more. It was right here on the aisle. Okay.
Yes, my name is Kevin Schenker. I'm really interested to see if you could apply your framework to the case of Germany, because I think that really touches upon what Peter said about reinventing and restructuring the algorithms in social media. And I invite you to do the exercise of sitting on YouTube and actually running a search on how to load a gun and click on 3-4 videos that are recommended, and you'll end up with videos on political discourse. So there is inherently that sort of imperative to really fix the algorithms, and this brings me back to the whole issue on how does that look in Germany, because it's the first time in Germany that we have a parliament sitting with sort of Nazi-affiliated ideals, and it's a country that has, for the first time, imposed a sort of governance structure on social media. If you look at the I don't know what the name was in English, NetzDG, famous law that came.
There's no name for that in English.
My question is, so first, how would you read, what is your reading on Germany, sort of helping restructure the algorithms? And then, I hate to mention his name, because there's sort of a Voldemort effect when you mention people like Jordan Peterson, but he is a really powerful public figure who makes 80,000 a month just off his views on YouTube, who speaks to this nostalgic population of men, primarily in the West, but I think he's arriving in Europe soon, if he's not already here. And I think he really questions the essence of who are we to really restructure the algorithms in a democratic society. He really ruffles a lot of feathers, and I have a hard time, I think a lot of people have a hard time reading him and sort of reading these arguments. And I think I'd just be curious to see what your thoughts are on that. Maybe
how much a month?
80,000.
You're in the wrong job.
Yeah,
you,
yeah.
You need to be a guru. You need to be a social guru.
Go ruffle some feathers.
So, would you like to take a slice of that?
Yeah, let me look at your excellent notes here.
So, I have my excellent.
So, I think there's sort of a nexus of questions around supply and demand, and when it is that populists turn up, and the electoral system that you have, right? I mean, I think the first thing to say that's interesting is that, especially in university, is that, you know, so I'm a political scientist, and I was trained by a set of people who always sort of, you know, the strongest in-group identity is not as being American or white or whatever, it's as being institutionalists, which is to say that, you know, for decades there was all of these dominant social scientists who never thought about institutions, and we think about institutions. I've never met a social scientist in my life who's not an institutionalist, and there must be somewhere. But it's sort of, it's a consensus view now, in many ways, that you have to think about how institutions mediate people's interests and so on. Well, I think one of the striking things about populism actually is to what extent it's risen in different systems, irrespective of the local institutions.
So you have PR systems, you have first past the post systems, you have presidential systems, you have parliamentary systems, and in one way or another, populists have managed to broken through regardless, which is really quite striking to me. Now, it would have been easy to think that it is that populists will rise more quickly in PR systems, actually, because you have less of a wasted vote problem. So as you go from 0 to 10% of support in the population, it's pretty easy to break through to parliament and so on and so forth. Well, but it turns out that in first-past-the-post systems, while you do have a wasted vote problem, it also then makes it more likely for populists to take over establishment parties rather than forming their own formations, or it then takes the form of things like referenda. So it turns out that, of course, the institutions shape a little bit what that populism looks like, but it doesn't resolve the problem, which is why, you know, when I go to Italy, people are like, we'll be fighting to get rid of any form of proportional representation, just go for first-past-the-post. And when I come to England, people say, oh, you know, first-past-the-post is a problem, you should have proportional representation. I don't believe that going from one to the other is the solution at all. Now, you know, I basically agree with Anne's sort of quick response to you, which is to say that, you know what, it's fluke. And there's a lot of just, when does a populist party congeal in the right way? They happen to have a leader who both manages to keep control of the party and is quite good at it. And there's a little bit of just randomness involved. I do think, though, that the opening now is much bigger than it was 30 or 50 years ago. And that's both because there's a much bigger stock of support and because it's been proven to work. That's what really scares me.
Work electorally. Yeah,
so 2 or 3 years ago in the United States, all of the smart people were saying, well, if you say you're going to lock up your opponent and things like that, nobody's going to vote for you. This is a crazy electoral strategy. Well, now it's been proven that that's not true. And that proof is not going away so fast. So that's going to make these populists, because a lot of it was not that, you know, look, America's a rich, raucous republic of 300 million people. You had people like Trump in the country always. But they didn't run for office. And if they did run for office, they didn't think
they
that
won
being
some
as extreme,
of the time. They won in
well,
Senate
local
seats and
state,
governors.
But
and,
they
yeah.
didn't do it at the national or presidential level. And so I think, you know, once you show that it's possible, and once you have the mutual support you now get, and the networks and so on, the political opportunity is going to be filled in most places. And some places are a little bit behind, took longer to congeal. Germany is one of those. But now that it's congealed, I think it's going to go the way that other countries have as well.
Is part of the supply, just thinking back to Russia, where you and I know so well, and this kind of the arrival of Alexei Navalny, there's something about the social media as an interface, which is all about a very raw and simple charisma. The way it was on radio and the way it wasn't on TV in some ways. It's very funny, my daughter watches a lot of YouTube, and she watches these YouTube stars. And I'm like, oh, I'll watch it with you. I'm into storytelling and narrative. My background is in television and just making documentaries. And I'm like, I was appalled by what she was watching. It's just people talking into the camera about their lives with no story, no narrative. No, I guess, you know, if narrative is ideology, no ideology. It was just pure, some sort of magic they had. And I guess some people just, maybe there's something about the medium itself which produces a certain type of charismatic, which we would have to divine, personality. So I wonder if, is that part of it? I don't know, I don't have an answer. But there is something about all these guys. They're bloody good on YouTube. I mean,
my question is, why so few Macrons? I agree that openings are big.
But I think Macron, in a way, I mean, I think that a lot of what we're seeing with populism now and this populist moment, it is a direct response to, as I said before, this doctrine of progress, right? That you have this doctrine of progress where a lot of people actually interpret that themselves as a period of decline. And then you also have the fact that the people promoting the doctrine of progress actually become the status quo. So there's a schism there between progress and change. And all of the people who are, you know, becoming successful as populists or and including Macron are promising radical change. So it is a kind of upheaval.
I mean, I said luck in response to what you said. And I actually genuinely think that. I mean, a lot of it is to do with which parties are in power. I mean, for example, which parties were in power at the time of the financial crisis and therefore got blamed for it. You know, and that was a matter of fluke. I mean, that was whether we were right. You know, the countries that had whoever was in charge then is generally the object of populist ire and dislike. I mean, I think some of what's happened in the Labour Party in this country, and actually the Democratic Party of the United States, is also part of that. You know, who's blamed for it? And that's fluke. And there's the other question is, in a lot of countries where populism is new and not all that well understood, the rest of the political system will often remain very divided against it. So we have almost as if the whole former system that we had, from the center left to the center right, and the Greens and the liberals, you know, who all remain pro the system, pro democracy, if you will, you know, pro liberal democracy, suddenly find themselves needing to unite against the populace, which has happened in several countries, and they just can't do it. I mean, they don't have a tradition of working together. They don't have a language that they can work with in common. They don't have a way of, you know, they don't see the danger until it's too late. I mean, this is of course the 1933 Germany problem, where nobody identified the rising threat. Everybody else was divided, and you can see that. Once again, Poland, just several other places.
One very quick thought on Macron and Ciudadanos. I mean, those are both places where political openings happened in part because of corruption scandals and so on, right? So what you need for a centrist party, I wouldn't call it populist, it's too long for this discussion, I don't think Macron is a populist, but what you have is more radical centrist parties.
No, he's anti-establishment, all right, though.
Yeah, he is. But and part of why you could get that in France is that we have a very unpopular left-wing president, so that takes the centre-left out, and then you have a centre-right candidate who's sort of hugely corrupt and pays his own family and so on. And so that's why Macron has an opening, right? Now, I think over time, these openings will arrive in other countries. And when you look at Germany, the Grand Coalition now has a moment to actually reform the country in important ways and really use the power it still has. It's not doing any of that. I mean, if you want to look at the status quo coalition, the Grand Coalition is that to the nth degree, whether it comes to Europe, whether it comes to the economy, whether it comes to anything. And the SPD is basically going to vanish. And the CDU is going to do more poor in 2021. I'm very worried about what that means in 2021 for governability. But that will create an opening for new parties, for example.
And just continuing on Germany, just to your point about the hate speech laws and this legislation. For those who don't know, basically in January this year, the German government brought in a new legislation which fines social media companies or technology companies 50 million euros for breaches of these laws. And the result is that these companies, well, they've put loads of resources, they've hired thousands of content moderators, but they are on the side of caution. Now, I have to say, from my focus groups in Germany, one of the absolutely strongest themes, and most concerning themes, was this ongoing narrative, particularly in the East, about the suppression of free speech. And people were often referencing this law. So it is not a model I think we should be following. I think it can be quite dangerous, and we should, you know, I think it's obviously been an interesting intervention. It's shown how the state can hold a real stick to these technology companies. So insofar as that, I think it is interesting. They have acted, they have responded. But the consequences on the social level are quite concerning. And I think on your point about algorithms and Jordan Peterson, just thinking about another report I did actually on the media and democracy and populism, and speaking with someone from the Sun newspaper about their website, and the Daily Mail, and the way in which it keeps refreshing itself so that the content that is being most visited is always at the top, and it just constantly has this process of evolution throughout the day. And a journalist there described it quite casually as a very democratic front page. And other journalists I spoke to were very critical of that and said, no, that you're confusing popularity with democracy. And I think that comes to this point.
Well, you know, the question is about algorithms is, could you, I mean, and this is just in theory, could you imagine, I don't know, the National Committee on Algorithms that at least debated, do we want Facebook to be, because what does Facebook do now? It maximizes attention. So what it want, whatever it is you're looking at the longest, that's what you're going to see more of. And so, is that as a society the thing that we want to maximize? You know, so if we were to start from scratch and invent Facebook as a public utility, might we not be maximizing something else? Might we not be pushing to the top of your newsfeed something different? And what would that be? I don't have I'm not going to give you a 2-word answer now. But it's an interesting thought experiment because then it shows what we could maybe do if we were able to if we could make this a public policy issue.
And there's a real difference, I think, between saying what kind of attributes should algorithms have. I'm not sure we should have legislation about that either.
I'm just making it up.
But certainly I think you can have some form of industry self-governance, or you can think of different kinds of models where it's not the government doing it directly. But that's quite different from what you have in Germany, where it is actually the government saying, if you publish this content on your platform, we're going to fine you a lot of money. And by the way, we're going to fine the executives of the company a lot of money as well. And that does, I think, come close to forms of censorship which are worrying to me. So to me, the answer to the social media piece is, in part, getting more responsibility for these kinds of companies and so on. The live feed has stopped and it's being restarted. That's quizzical looks here.
It's because we got to algorithms and the algorithm shut us down.
Yeah, exactly. How dare they?
How dare they say this? All right.
It was my idea that we have a national committee on algorithms. Turn off.
Well, I think part of it also is, though, we're never going to just deal with it through the supply of noxious ideas on the internet. It's always going to be possible to go and find horrible ideas on the internet. I think unless we want to become a radically unfree society, that is just the new normal that we live in. But part of what we can do is the things that the people in your survey say, which is to say we should actually promote a set of common narratives, the most important one of which is about the value of our political system and what it is that we actually want to preserve in liberal democracy that can at least reduce the demand for some of those ideas to a certain extent.
Right. Let me take a few more comments. We'll end in at 8. So, is it Eric? Did you want to say something? So, this is Eric Bergloff, head of the Institute for Global Affairs.
Yeah, well done. A lesser version of Sergei. I had it's more like a comment maybe, but it's so I was thinking about what Sophie was describing. So we did a survey of sort of life satisfaction and people's attitudes and expectations in Eastern Europe and comparing to Western Europe. And before the financial crisis, what really stood out was, of course, these countries had gone through tremendous upheaval, and they had had many countries that had lost 50% of their output, and for most people, tremendous sacrifice. But what really stood out compared to Western Europe was this sense that, not nostalgia, but actually our children are going to be better than us, are going to have a better life than us. Hmm. And there was this sense that this had already been lost in Western Europe at that time. You're talking about the mid-2000s. When you ask about now, you have the fact that the global financial crisis and whatever happened in Eastern Europe, which was the region most affected by the global financial crisis, was that their impact on their attitude was smaller than, because they had experienced a very severe crisis before in the early 90s. But what had changed was that they no longer expected that their children would be better off. Mm. And when you think, there's probably nothing more profound than a society's change when you think that your children will not have a better life. So in a sense, it's not about nostalgia, it's about the future. And I think it's that sense that created a breeding ground for populism. And of course, if you add to that, and you said something I think also very profound, is that there is this sense of a limited amount of resources available. You had some word that sort of captured it very well. And of course, it's in that limited amount of resources available that immigration comes in. Mm-hmm. So suddenly you think that this is a kind of zero-sum game, and they're going to take away from those limited amounts. And we project into the future that there will be less for everybody, including our children, because the immigrants come. And I'm Swedish, and you can say we have had exactly that experience. And
A couple more. Maybe I'll go on this side now. There's two women right there, one in red and one in black. So.
I have two comments and one question. I just had a Polish colleague over, and she actually said exactly what you mentioned earlier, that she was like, we actually expected to be on the level of West Germany, and we are actually disappointed that we're not there. And I was really surprised when she said that. And then the comment was a bit towards what you said, we could do something about the algorithm and to target our message and to build that. I'm just wondering, I mean, if you don't change anything with the underlying problems, do you really then, just by tweaking the message, do you get somewhere there?
Unless the problem is the message.
That would lead to... I sometimes have the feeling that we as elite are more connected to, you know, somebody in Berlin or somebody in New York. We have more in common to that, to those people, than to people who live here in London with us in the East End. So if you, how do you signal earnestly that you are actually interested in, you know, the well-being of the people who happen to live in this country, no matter what colour they are, but, you know, how do you build that nationalism in a credible way when you kind of like, you know, you seem to have more in common with, you know, somebody in India in your group, in your social group?
Let's take one more.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth. And I have a thought. Are we taking for granted segmentation? Is perhaps, you know, the problem is that we're commercializing the public sphere and thinking about broadcasting political messages to different audiences, and that by itself is not inclusive or not building, you know, a place where everybody can talk.
Yeah. So, no, that's exactly the problem.
So
yeah.
The segmentation,
yeah.
That it's a basic of every political campaign.
Yeah.
And not be, and then that's exacerbated by, you know, algorithms and all the rest. So...
No, I mean, the problem with segmentation is, the question is, we know that's, I agree with you, we know the political campaigns are segmenting us and transmitting different messages and so on. The question is that now the new normal? Is that just how everything is going to be from now on, and we therefore have to readjust our thinking about politics to that? That's my, I don't have an answer.
I think that's the closest to disagreement we've come to on the panel, and I can implicitly get it from your answer right now as well. I think that's quite interesting to bring out, right? So... We all agree that segmentation is a problem, that it is what divides us and so on and so forth. I think what we might disagree about on the panel is whether that is an inevitable outcome of social media or if that is partially to the kind of campaigns that politicians run. And I actually think
that... advertisers, but yeah.
Right. So I think that it is possible to have a message of unity that is a bold message, it can't be a status quo message, about what you want to do in a country that nevertheless is sort of relatively moderate. And then you're still going to bring it to different groups in different ways. It's not like you're not going to use the basics, you know, tools that you have on social media in order to slightly target different groups in different ways and, you know, have videos of different spokespeople who are going to speak to them more and so on. But I still think it's possible to have a basically unifying message that speaks to Americans as Americans, to Brits as Brits, rather than to sub-identities and subgroups. And to win a campaign like that. But I get the sense that Anne and Peter are more skeptical about, so I'd love to ask a question to you.
No, that's definitely the hope. That's, so far we've seen that technology, well, in the way that's exactly what we said Hillary Clinton did, and it flopped. We've seen that technology used in a different political strategy, but I'm certainly not a overly, you know, it could be just be a wave, and then, you know, you get to do it in a different way. To be honest, you know what, the one thing that does better online than messages of hate? So we're talking about group polarization, or online, usually hate messages do really, really well. Mm. The ones that do worst, reasoned arguments. You know, that does really badly. Hate does very, very well, but way bigger than hate is something that I hear described as awe. And awe means giving people a sense there's something bigger than themselves and a positive message. So still the biggest things on social media are some of Obama's speeches and stuff like that. So it's definitely there. That's, I mean, that potential is latent, but so far definitely sort of like what we mean by populism, a strategy here is saying there are people and non-people. is doing much better. Yeah. So far, that logic has won. I hope it wouldn't be in the future. But there was a really important point you were talking about, the message and stuff like that. I hate all this this language around narratives and messages as if that's something separate from the rest of the issues that we've been discussing. I think what we're talking about is, as we look for these solutions to the economic issues and the issues of representation, we have to do that in a space where we're talking to each other. So how do we foster that space is really the question that we're looking at. How do we generate that space when the old space of doing that has kind of collapsed? Again, going back to the election, it was very interesting. I was following the journalists during the election, and their story summed it up. So back in the kind of Tony Blair days, there was a bus, and Tony Blair announced to Campbell would woo every journalist, trying to bring them in to their message. Yeah? That was a time when you're trying to win the centre, trying to convince, you know, lots of people that you have one nice unifying message. Then there was the time of debates, yeah, when audience, you know, when different in Britain, when you had different political parties still trying to go on the BBC at least and try to win debates. But this election, there was no debate anymore. There was no attempt to win the centre anymore. Yeah, there was an interview with Corbyn and May separately, and they did separate messages to separate audiences essentially. And then there was no bus for journalists. Nobody was even trying to woo the journalists anymore. Basically, both camps knew the journalists couldn't very well find where Theresa May was going to appear next day. Mm. Corbyn avoided journalists. So they already knew that they were going to give, you know, little bits of information to their people, so the Daily Mail and Telegraph, the Canary over here, and play up those little subgroups. And there wasn't even an attempt to sort of engage in a real debate.
So, I mean, and then I guess my question would be, is that just now the world we have to live in and we need to learn how to make it better, or are there unifying messages? Anyway, Sophie.
Well, I feel relatively optimistic about Britain in terms of the fact that we have potential here, I think, to actually be turning things around. I don't think there's a fait accompli here. I think that one example of this is the fact that despite everyone expressing nostalgia, despite this nostalgia position being a consensus position, and despite it being absolutely endemic in our political cultures, the term itself remains a taboo. Nobody wants to be accused of being nostalgic. And the same citizens that will tell me, you know, everything is terrible, everything was better in the past, the next question I always ask is, you know, what are the defining characteristics of being British? What makes us Brits? And they will always, initially, the first thing they will always say is our optimism.
We're so future orientated.
I've been grappling with this. What is this paradox? And I think actually this doctrine of progress has been so deeply embedded. I think everyone really drank the Kool-Aid, and it's quite a nice story. So I think there is still the capacity to shift people back to looking towards the future. But I think politicians are just sleepwalking on this, and there's a very cheap trick here that they're all buying into. You know, there is a winning strategy, as you say. It is going to take it's much more difficult to think of really compelling narratives that can take people into the future together in a united way. It's much more difficult than just playing to your base. I think the Democrats are actually grappling with this a little bit ahead of the midterms, and I think just more generally, because do they play to a strategy of just voter mobilization for a very specific few constituencies, or do they try and reach across the divide and speak to...
Actually,
you're
reminding me of the Bill Clinton's famous campaign slogan, which is, we're going to build that bridge to the 21st century. Do you remember this? He said over and over and over again. So that was exactly what that was.
I've been mulling Peter's comment about, you know, what works really well is hate and what works even better is awe. And I think there's an interesting point about those two things, which is that it's really easy to mobilize hate. There's always somebody who people hate, and if not, you can invent them. You know, that's a strategy that is always available, and anybody can play it, right? Somebody who's bad-looking and old and whatever, they start to hate, and it speaks to the people who are receptive to that. Awe is much more difficult to produce. You have to have a candidate who's much more charismatic and so on. And often, when you think of the most charismatic candidates, they were charismatic in part because they were responding to a sense of, you know,
W has been in power for 8 years. We're sick of that, right? The Tories have been in power for 25 years. It's at moments when you're the alternative to something that's been there for a long time that it's easier to mobilize that kind of charisma and awe and so on. And so the problem with that it's a very rare strategy. We can't rely on it at every turn. Now, there is a strategy in politics that I think did used to work, but it's neither awe nor hate. And it goes back to your point, which is, most people think the future is going to be better, and they trust that even non-awe-inspiring politicians can help them deliver that. And and I think a huge problem we haven't talked about enough today is just the complete loss of trust in that. That people no longer think, and you talked about that a little bit, they no longer think, hey, politicians are actually going to deliver something for us. And if you don't, then it's so much more tempting to go for the person who just expresses your hate, and you don't really expect to get anything out of them, but at least they say what you think, than it is to go for those politicians. So how do we build back a politics that can mobilize awe at times to get back in power and so on, but that can then actually regain the trust that, you know what, even if a politician is a little boring, even if it is not an awe-inspiring moment, I trust him to actually do something for me. That's a really tough challenge.
I think with that, we will end, because with the clock has struck 8, which is when this... when this event is supposed to be over. Thank you all very much. It was really interesting. And we hope to continue it next week, exactly a week from tonight. I am doing this again with Ivan Krastev, slightly different themes.
Krastev is the best. You need to come.
Slightly different conversation, much more Central European humor and Soviet jokes. Anyway, thank you very much. Thank you all. And Yasha's books are available.